longer. Then I need to get back to work on the light whip. That seemed to lift Kit's spirits. When will it be ready to test? Obi-Wan sighed. I've never actually built one, but I saw a bounty hunter wield one once in the Kornak cluster. The theory is clear enough, and I found a diagram in the archives. Just remember, if covert action becomes necessary, all suspicion must fall on Count Dooku. If you are seen wielding a lightsaber, you'll be identified as a Jedi. Concluding his practice session, Obi-Wan freshened himself and donned a new robe. He then went out to the lower deck lounge. There he found Barrister Snoyle studying at two computer workstations, each of his eye stalks engaged with a different holographic display. A useful skill, Obi-Wan said. You comprehend both simultaneously? Snoyle turned, startled.
Master Kenobi, I didn't realize you were there. As to your question, yes, my people can split attention between sides of their brain. The full reintegration will not take place until sleep tonight.
Genuine concern creased Snoyle's glistening face.
Actually, I am glad you are here. I was hoping we might confer.
On what matter?
These treaties!
His falsetto rose to a squeak.
A nightmare! Ord Cestus was never supposed to be a major industrial power. When it was initially set up, Coruscant granted it quite favorable trade terms. The point was for the prism to be self-sufficient and not a burden to the Republic.
And now?
And now the prison exists as a legal fiction only. A definition expanded to include the entire planet. Cestus markets goods under a corrections license.
Snoyle paused, eye stalks wavering almost hypnotically.
Delicate. If we threaten a suspension of activity while their status is reevaluated, that should panic them.
Right into Dooku's arms, Obi-Wan said. Hardly a desirable outcome. Their transport cruiser made its initial descent into a section of the Dashta plain selected for the tiny amount of electromagnetic activity in the area, evidence that there was little or no entrenched population. The off-worlders wished to avoid prying eyes. Ahead lay work best done in privacy. For an hour, the troopers humped crates and rucksacks full of gear out of the ship. Kit insisted on carrying his own equipment, and the troopers were happy to let him do it. The Jedi was as strong as any two of them. For half the trip, Obi-Wan had labored on the weapon now coiled at Kit's side. Kit had a reputation for improvisation, and within hours he handled the light whip as if he had been spawned with it. Obi-Wan turned to Kit and extended his hand. Well, he said, this is where we part. For now, Kit said. We'll set up base camp in the cave south of here and begin operations within a day. After that, we'll be ready for whatever comes. I'm sure you will, Obi-Wan said. Communication on Astromech remote maintenance channels shouldn't alert the security. We'll disguise our conversation as modulations of the basic carrier frequency. Kit nodded. A good idea. May the Force be with you. The four remaining clone troopers stayed behind with Kit. Obi-Wan walked back up into the ship, and the door sealed behind him. He strapped himself into the empty chair next to the pilot, CTX-270, checked to make sure Dulb Snoyle was safe, and then nodded, Let's go, Zootu. Kit checked the instrumentation on his Aratech 74Z speeder bike, modified military hardware as maneuverable as a hawk bat and capable of speeds up to 550 kilometers per hour. He raised his hand, and the clone troopers mounted their own speeders as if they had practiced that single maneuver for a month. He triggered the speeder. The purr became a growl as it lifted. In perfect formation, the five sailed through the gullies and along rivers through a tumble of low brown scrub brush. Kilometer by kilometer, they progressed toward their goal, the Dashta Mountains. far to the west. Obi-Wan's transport headed straight for Cestus' capital city, Chicant Lick, a Jiting word meaning the center. Zutu handled the controls with supreme confidence, as if he had been born piloting ships. Then again, for all practical purposes, he had. One of Cestus's primary features was the vast network of tunnels, created by volcanic activity, water erosion, and millennia of digging by the once vast Jiting hives. It was these caves that had made it such a perfect choice for a prison planet, and it was into one of the larger lava tubes that their ship descended. Obi-Wan caught a few briefly snatched glimpses of graffiti, and then networks of pipe and steel, mazes of rigging, clearly the product of endless generations of workers. They zoomed down another tunnel and turned left. Chicant Lick's offices and apartments blended with the volcanic structures so perfectly that it was difficult to see where they ended and mortal workings began. Their ship spiraled down through the towers and roadways, heading to a central landing pad at the outskirts of their destination, some kind of major living complex. As the ship came softly to rest, one of the side screens showed a line of uniformed human males standing at attention. Dulb Snoyle's emerald eye stalks quivered with excitement.
Look at the honor guard!
Yes, Obi-Wan replied. It must be rare to see representatives from Coruscant out here on the rim. The guards were near-human Kefar, who immediately snapped to attention as the door opened and the ramp touched down. Master Kenobi, it is my pleasure to welcome you to Chicant Lick, the nearest guard said. I've only just received word that the regent is on parley. Hive business. She returns tonight and will meet with you tomorrow. Obi-Wan nodded sagely, and Snoyle's eye stalks bobbed with pleasure. A band composed of assorted droid musicians blared a medley of melodic bleeps and hoots, doubtless the Sestian planetary anthem, as Obi-Wan, Snoyle, and their astromech unit descended. The band next performed a passable rendition of the Republic's official anthem, All Stars Burn as One. Once upon a time, that song had quickened Obi-Wan's blood, but for the last months, he had begun to bristle whenever he heard it. Welcome to Cestus, General Kenobi, Barrister Snoyle. Obi-Wan nodded. Thank you, Sergeant. I hope that old business can be completed quickly, that I might have an opportunity to appreciate the beauty of your world before I return home. The words flowed so smoothly that Obi-Wan laughed to himself. In truth, he might have made a passable politician. Peacemakers and power brokers had to meet to find common ground, and if he had chosen that path. With that thought in his mind, and a resultant half-smile curling his lips, Obi-Wan allowed himself and Snoyle to be escorted to a railway running above the free-flying transport lanes.
Few buildings on the planet's surface,
Snoyle asked.
Why?
The natural caverns were easy to exploit for prison space, and safer from dust storms and raiding aboriginals. That was long ago. And now? Obi-Wan asked. Their guide shrugged. The plagues left a lot of hives empty. We just moved in. They approached a particularly large and beautiful expanse of carved rock wall. Only on a second look did it resolve into a building. Our destination, the guard said. What is it? Obi-Wan asked. It was almost a kilometer across, one of the largest city constructs Obi-Wan had seen on a Rimworld. The Grand Chicant Lick was the first actual prison built here, their guide said. It was converted 50 years ago, and now serves as our finest hotel. They entered what appeared to be a lava tube, and emerged in the hotel lobby. The interior was quite literally cavernous, a lobby built around a luminous natural hot spring, lift tubes thrusting up through cascading shelves of frozen limestone. The silvery protocol droid concierge approached them, fairly shivering with excitement.
Welcome. You are now guests of the most luxurious hotel on Ord Cestus.
Snoyle's fleshy lips curled in appreciation.
After days on the shuttle, it's good to have a room, not a cabin,
he squeaked. Two Jiting attendants materialized, just as their luggage cart appeared behind them. Obi-Wan noted that one of the Jiting wore a name tag reading Fizik. Kit Fisto, Nate, and his three brothers had arrived stealthily, making their initial surveillance of the Dashta mountain region specified by their mysterious contact, Sheikha Tull. Tull had designated a cave hidden beneath an overhanging rock shelf, opening onto a broad, flat stone theater that could be used as an emergency landing zone. On first glance, the cave looked ideal, but Kit entered gingerly, sensor tendrils tingling. The shaggy, desiccated body of some four-legged mammal, half the size of a speeder bike, lay just inside the cave. He nudged the body aside and took another step forward. Nothing living to be seen. Side tunnels stretched off in multiple directions.
There might be something here,
Nate said, coming up behind him.
Perhaps we should find another cave,
CT-12/74 said. Not until we make contact with Tull, Kit said. Here in the shelter of a craggy valley, almost completely devoid of all but the simplest vegetation, they spent the first hours building their base camp and sleeping quarters, assembling sections of modular housing. They were so engrossed in their work that they barely noticed when the first of the cave spiders appeared. Kit cursed himself for not recognizing the webs or the ragged, furry, desiccated corpses for what they were. But when the first eight-legged monstrosity bounced out of the shadows to leap onto Surtee, the Nautilin moved instantly. The spider screamed as his lightsaber seared through a leg. Then the trooper bucked it off, putting three shots into the beast before the body hit the ground. They hardly had time to congratulate themselves. Six cave spiders of equal size crawled from the darkness. Kit ordered the troopers into perfect square formation, shoulder blasters at the ready as their eight-legged attackers emerged. A cascade of cave spider silk jetted toward the trooper diagonal from Kit, Nate. The trooper shoulder rolled and came up to firing position, blasted the rocks above the spider's hiding place. As stones rained down on the unfortunate creature, Nate rolled again and ran to one of the speeder bikes. Immediately behind Kit, a great, shaggy, eight-legged beast hissed and leapt. He pivoted, lightsaber singing. The spider bounded out of the way, landing in a crouch. It bounded again, spitting venom. Kit dodged to the side, lightsaber swatting one of the caustic greenish gobs, and the fluid erupted into searing steam. He glimpsed movement and turned to see a gigantic red female, half the size of a bantha, crouching in the shadows, watching, her glowing eyes fixed on him. A general directing her troops. Nate's speeder bike started instantly. Under his expert hands, it leapt off the cave floor and ran in a tight circle, buzzing the shadows, turning tight corners, drawing out the spiders. They spit silk and venom at him, and every time they did, his brothers below got a better fix. The trooper wove, using the speeder's maneuverability to confuse the spiders. Their eight-legged adversaries were quicker on the ground, but seemed baffled by this high-flying tactic. General Fisto gave a whistle so loud and high that it rattled Nate's ears at 20 meters. The other troopers broke for their speeders, and within moments, the cave was filled with screaming, dipping, blasting speeder bikes. At least six of the large spiders and dozens of the smaller ones had perished in blasts, lightsaber strokes, and showers of falling rock before they retreated shrieking into the caves. The largest, the enormous red-furred female, protected the others as they fled. The troopers started to pursue, but the general raised his hands.
No!
They're broken. Let the brood go. The female locked eyes with the general. Surprisingly, she lowered her head as if making obeisance, and then backed into the shadows and disappeared.
Perimeter sensors up immediately, General Fisto said.
So we're staying here, sir?
Nate asked.
Might as well assume all these caves are spider-infested. At least we know this one is clear.
Besides that, Surtee whispered to Nate when General Fisto turned away. We fought for it. It's ours. As the others set up in the cave, Kit Fisto carried his broadcasting unit a kilometer out to a completely desolate area with no line of sight to their new camp. There he triggered his beacon and sat in wait. After 5 seconds, he turned it off. He waited 5 minutes, then broadcast for another 5 seconds, and set the automatic monitor to continue in like sequence. 5 minutes off, 5 seconds on. After an hour, he heard an answering squeal in proper coded series. He turned off the monitor and waited. The sun was nearing the western horizon when a battered cargo ship appeared from the south. It flew in a slow, groaning circle and then settled toward the ground, frying the underbrush as it did. The panel door opened and a ramp descended. Kit heard a bleeping sound, and then a human female appeared at the top. Kit had few standards by which to assess human beauty. Based on her movements and posture, however, this female was in excellent physical condition. Her unblemished black skin and lustrous short hair suggested a healthy immune system, and she seemed quite aware and alert. The woman studied Kit, her expression one of exasperation. "A Nautilin. Pretty far from an ocean, aren't you?" The Jedi was unamused. "I'm waiting," he said. She rolled her eyes. "No sense of humor. All right. Alderaan has 3 moons. Demos 4, but 2. Kit replied, without hesitation. "Name Sheikha Tal. I was told to expect you." "What precisely were you told?" "They said if I helped you, certain things in my past would be forgotten. That right?" She looked back up at him, defiance sparkling in her eyes. He nodded, and she seemed relieved. "So, what do you need?"
"What I need is a reliable contact. There were cave spiders."
She shook her head. "There are spiders all through these mountains, but I didn't see any when I checked out that cave. Sorry." Kit locked eyes with her, a test of wills. Was she telling the truth? She was his contact, given by the Chancellor's most trusted tacticians. Trust was his only option. "Very well. I must speak to the anarchists known as Desert Wind." She nodded and drew a little circle in the dust with the point of her toe. "All right, then," she said. "Time for you to meet Spin Dragon." The insectile Cestian's name was Physic, and at the moment he was at his most aggressively ambitious, in the peak of his species' 3-year cycle between male and female genders. In his current state, the coursing of masculine hormones was a nerve-dulling intoxicant, and made him willing to take almost any risk to obtain the medicine that would balance the hormones more smoothly. The plant capable of easing or even accelerating the transition was called Viptral, native to a world called Nal Hatta, far too expensive for a mere hotel attendant. And that was why Physic decided to sell his soul to his distant brother Trillet. He waddled his bright gold oval through the crowd until he found a certain alley, disguised as a minor lava tube. In his female persona, Physic often secured domestic work amid the off-worlder upper classes. When he cycled back to male, most off-worlder employers found his powerful pheromones sufficiently unpleasant to terminate his employment. Moving between social tissues over the years had earned him a wide network of contacts, a net wide enough, in fact, to have snared a valuable bit of information: that the Grand Chicatlic's newest arrivals were critically important visitors from Coruscant. There was every chance he might be able to sell such information to one of the most powerful Jiting in the capital, the being who held the threads connecting the criminal underworld to the labor organizers, to the true masters of Old Cestus, Physic's brother Trillet. In a few minutes, he arrived at a heavy oval iron door set in a shadowed corridor off bustling Orr Boulevard. The guards, one blue-skinned humanoid Runian and a gigantic furred Wookiee, glared down on Physic with no discernible shift in their facial expressions.
need to see my brother,
Fizek said, and added a code word known only to Hive siblings. The guards nodded blandly and opened the door. At first, Fizek could see only a broad couch, but as his eyes adjusted to the darkness, he was able to make out his brother. Trillet was three broods senior to Fizek. Like Fizek, he was a minor child of a noble but impoverished broodmother. His only inheritance, a yearning for the wealth and power of ages past. Unlike Fizek, however, Trillet had talent and a willingness to take risks. After a false start working at communications for Cestus Cybernetics, he found his niche in labor relations. Trillet's three-year cycle between male and female personae tended to keep his immigrant opponents and rivals slightly off guard. Fizek knew that, unlike most Jiting, Trillet used an imported cocktail of victual and other exotic herbs to collapse the month-long breeding period at either end of the gender cycle into mere hours of numbed transformation. No incapacity, no fertility. No mewling grubs for one as ambitious as Trillet. 5 years later, Trillet had proven his worth to a local Tenlo syndicate, and 2 years after that, he resigned from Cestus Cybernetics to work directly for the overboss himself. A mysterious series of unexplained and tragic accidents had cleared the way for Trillet's ascension. Well, unexplained as long as Trillet himself chose not to comment. Everything that followed was almost preordained. Seeing Trillet's utter ruthlessness, and perhaps sensing the inevitability of his ascension, the overboss fled Cestus, leaving the power in Trillet's capable hands. In the twilight zone between labor and management, between white and black market, between upper and lower class, between off-worlder and Jiting Hive Council, there was no fixer like Trillet. And everyone knew it. Like most male Jiting, he was a deceptively delicate insectile creature. His every motion seemed as carefully cultivated and pondered as a master's game of Dejarik. A high crystalline brow over faceted eyes and an elongated oval for a body gave the impression of vast intelligence and great gentility. Fizek knew that only the former impression was correct. But Trillet's thorax was red and swelling, a clear sign of feminization. Such a rapid shift had to be agonizing, and Fizek wondered what herbs and drugs Trillet used to control the pain. Trillet spoke to the guard in a clicking, popping language that seemed odd emerging from this strangely prim mouth. The guard answered in the same indecipherable tongue. Then his head pivoted to face his guest.
Ah, Fizek, he said. It seems you have information for me. Of course, if your information is sound, there will be compensation.
For hours, the clone troopers had busied themselves in the cool, deep shadows of the Dashta Mountains. They glued, fitted, and welded, joining together hundreds of preformed durasteel sections, melding them with native materials to create the nucleus of a fine command center. Their comlink bleeped. A tone said that they'd be expecting friendly visitors in a little under a minute, and they were not to respond with force. That beacon triggered long before they heard the distant but distinct swoosh of air. A few seconds later, General Fisto's speeder bike appeared. Nate wandered out to the pad, feeling loose, dangerous, and satisfied. In a matter of hours, they had turned this mountain hole into a reasonable headquarters. He watched the Nautilin speeder glide over the smooth and jagged rock surfaces heading north. Nate followed on foot, arriving in time to watch a cargo ship arrive on the open spot they'd chosen as their secondary landing zone. The door opened and the walkway extended. A dark-skinned human female exited, following Kit back up toward the cave. Nate saluted as Kit passed. The woman glanced at him with little curiosity as she and Kit entered the cave. The Jedi received salutations from the other clones. He briefly evaluated the work that they had already performed, then took the woman to a scanner and showed her some material. They conferred briefly, and Kit said,
"Captain, Forey, I wish you to accompany us."
"Yes, sir,"
they said simultaneously. Spindragon was a suborbital YT-1200 medium freighter. She was old, melded with parts from other similar models, with a rounded hull and an elongated tubular cockpit. Nate spent a few minutes examining the welds. Although it was obvious that a dozen different soldering mixtures had been used, as well as a bit of Corellian epoxy, they seemed strong enough to stand up to high G-turns, and he gave his approval. The woman cocked her head sideways at the ARC trooper, trying to peer through his helmet.
"I didn't catch your name," she said.
"Trooper A98,"
she snorted. "Is there a short version of that?"
"Call me Nate."
Within minutes, they were all strapped in and ready to go. She rose from their landing pad and spiraled up into the sky, flying southeast for about 15 minutes, then north for another 10. A small manufacturing complex lay before them. Nate made a quick tactical assessment. Several mine dropshaft shacks, living quarters, a small refinery, some shipping docks, landing docks, water filtration equipment, and communications towers. He and Forey were first down the ramp when it extended, followed by Sheikah Tull and the Jedi. The community seemed to have turned out for them, but he noticed that there were precious few Jating in the crowd. Most were humans, a few were Wookiees, and there was a smattering of other species. The farmers and miners relaxed noticeably when Sheikah appeared, and she waved to them.
"Greetings to all of you," she said to them. "I'm glad you showed up, though I can't say I'm sure what this is about. But these are the people I told you to expect. I won't vouch for them. Keep your ears and eyes open and make up your own minds."
They nodded, and Nate had to respect her speech. Tull might be willing to bring them here, but even whatever leverage the Republic had upon her could not force her to sell her honor by pretending friendship. Good. He liked her more all the time. General Fisto stood at the bottom of the ramp and raised his hands. His tentacles curled and coiled hypnotically.
"Miners," he called. "You harvest ore from the soil. You transport, refine, and manufacture. You are this world's heart."
The faces were doubtful but intrigued. Nate noted that several of the younger ones looked at him as well, studying him as if wishing his helmet were transparent.
"You stir the tides of commerce," the general went on. "It is your hands that hold the materials, skills, equipment, and raw material to build their luxuries. But despite this fact, how often have you been included in their decisions?"
"Never," someone muttered.
"How often have you shared in their harvest? There is nothing wrong with growing wealthy, but the wealth should be shared with those who do the dirtiest, most dangerous work."
As he proceeded, the emotion in his voice grew more and more pronounced.
"Your ancestors came here in chains. For all the power you wield, you may as well wear them still."
He had their interest now, but he would need far more to make this gambit successful.
"Even now, your masters court war with the Republic."
This triggered a series of gasps and ugly murmurs.
"Why are they doing that?"
an older woman asked.
"They sell these deadly droids to the Confederacy. They will be modified and used against the Republic. In fact, we have information suggesting that they plan to mass market these droids off-planet once the secret is secured."
"What? It couldn't happen. The guides,
A female miner began, but then the farmer to Nate's right gave her ribs a painful elbow thump, and she fell silent.
"You have been told that it is impossible for more than a few hundred of them to be produced because of the Dashta eels, but they are willing to gamble with your survival in order to make their fortunes."
"How do you know that?" one young blonde-haired man asked.
The five families live here. You can't sink half a sand wagon, Nautilin.
Yes, they live here, Kit replied, but are not trapped here. Wealth makes many things possible. Those owning the designs will grow fat. You must ask yourself, would those who already restrict you to a subsistence living hesitate to beggar you completely?
An ugly murmur rumbled through the crowd.
You tell me. Over the last years and decades, have they treated you as if your lives, your families, your needs and wants are of concern to them?
And now there was a wider range of nodding and agreement. One Jating female, a tuft of red fur vibrant between thorax and chin, her body broad with internal egg sac, stepped forward. She was larger than most of the human males, who gave her a wide berth.
What you want from us?
Her clumsy speech marked her as a low caste.
No more pretty talk. Heard them before. What you offer us, and what you want from us.
I offer you nothing, save what every planet in the Republic has been promised. A fair voice in the Senate, access to the shared resources of 1,000 star systems, and our support in forcing your government to share the wealth with those who produce it. What I ask in return is this. If I prove my point to you, if we can prove that your leaders are prepared to sell your birthright, to betray the Republic, to leave you drowning in the ash of a war-torn planet while they escape to the stars with your children's heritage, if I can prove these things to you.
At this cue, Nate and Fauri doffed their helmets and stood more rigidly. Their identical faces always caused a stir. Some thought them twins. Others had heard of the clone army and just needed to put a face to the mental image. Sheikah Tull's eyes snapped wide. She stepped backward as if she'd been slapped. She looked from Nate to Fauri and back again three times, and then retreated until he couldn't see her.
That you allow your best and brightest to join us if they so choose,
the general concluded. The general promised to keep the farmers posted as to progress, and they continued on to the next group. For the rest of the day, they followed the same routine. The dark-skinned woman would introduce them, and General Fisto went into his spiel while Nathan Forey stood tall. After the third talk, the Nautilin was engaged by a group of miners who seemed entranced by this exotic visitor from the Galactic Center. The general interacted with the group privately, with the result that the four of them were invited to sup with the hosts and their families. Both from habit and because it added to their mystique, Nate and Fauri ate apart from the others. To Nate's surprise, Sheikah Tull chose to sit beside him. Nate ate quietly for several minutes before he found himself studying the play of the dark skin of her neck against the red and white stripes of her pilot's jacket, and found himself intrigued. He decided to try a conversational gambit.
Good meat, he said. What is it?
Not meat, she said. It's a mushroom bred by the Jating, adapted for human stomachs. They can make it taste like anything they like. He stared at his sandwich. The fungus had striations like meat, tasted like meat. He bet it had a perfect amino acid profile, too. He chewed experimentally, and then just relaxed and enjoyed.
Why are you here? He asked.
What do you mean?
You weren't born here, he said.
And how do you know that?
Your pronunciation is different. You learned basic after your native tongue.
She laughed, but it was a long, low laugh, without derision.
Where'd you learn to think like that?
Intelligence training. How'd you end up here?
She leaned her head back against the tree.
Sometimes I feel like I've been everywhere and done everything, she said.
Where's your family?
Why in space had he asked that?
My birth parents?
You're not a clone, are you?
He meant it as a joke. Her face hardened.
Yes, I had parents.
You lost them.
It wasn't a question.
For more than a minute, she said nothing, and he hoped his words hadn't offended.
A range war, on a Triva 7, she said. It was a bad time.
She stared down at the dirt.
Maybe I was attracted to Ord Cestus because it was so isolated, so far from the hub.
I guess it wasn't isolated enough. I met someone. A miner named Yander.
You fell in love? Nate asked.
Her mood lightened.
That's what they call it. It wasn't just him. It was his three children, too. Tarl, Tonote, and Mithail. His whole community.
She glanced away from him for a second, then back again.
I fell in love with all of them. We married. Yander and I had 4 good years together. More than a lot of people get.
Something caught in her voice, and he cursed himself for invading her privacy. Finally, he managed the simple words. I'm sorry.
So am I. Shikatal sighed. So anyway, I'm raising his kids. Never had a lot of family. I want to raise the one I have now.
That's why I'm willing to take the chance to help you guys. Clean up my record.
What leverage do they have on you?
She shook her head.
Maybe when we know each other better.
When? Not if. Interesting. Does your new family live near here? Again, she shifted evasively, and he sensed that he had touched on a sensitive topic.
No, not here. With their aunt and uncle. A fungus farming community.
So, she worked to care for her adopted family, who lived with the miner's brother and sister. She was reticent to discuss the children or their location. Hard to say. Interesting.
As he came out of his thoughts, again he had the sense that she was staring at him, and this time he felt uncomfortable.
Why do you look at me that way?
She shook her head. Then, as if she thought herself the biggest fool in the galaxy, she shook with peals of deep, rich laughter.
I suppose I keep expecting you to remember me. That's crazy, of course.
She laughed again, and Nate just felt more confused.
I suppose I should have told you before. I knew Jango Fett.
You did?
She nodded.
Yes.
20 years ago. In quite another life. Seeing you was kind of a shock.
When you took those helmets off, wow!
Her laugh was throaty and vibrant.
It's him, all right, and just about the age he was when we first met.
Nate's head spun.
I should have expected that, I suppose. Certainly some of my brothers have also encountered people who had known him. I've just never spoken to one.
Wow.
She scratched in the dirt with her toe.
And the other troopers? They're all little Jangos?
He bristled, and she laid her hand on his arm.
Just a joke. You know, joke.
The Republic called for a clone army, he said, and recited the words that he had heard and said 1,000 times before. They needed a perfect role model for a fighting man. In all the galaxy, they found only one. Jango Fett.
Oh, he wasn't perfect, but he was a serious chunk.
Her smile grew more mischievous.
And he's now the father of a whole army of bouncing baby clones. What does he think of that?
He's dead.
The pause that followed might have swallowed a decent-sized star cruiser.
How did it happen?
She whispered. Nate cleared his throat, surprised to find it more constricted than he thought.
One of his clients was a traitor. Jango Fett didn't know this when he accepted the contract, and once he had given his word, there was no other choice. It took 12 Jedi to kill him.
He looked at her sharply, expecting her to challenge his words.
So Django was killed by the Jedi.
She jerked a thumb at Kit Fisto.
And there they strut. Bother you?
He shook his head slowly.
No. We are under contract as well. Contract made with our blood. We were born to serve. And in that service, find life's greatest gift. A meaningful existence.
She shook her head.
Heed how?
She said. Django wasn't the philosophical type.
Curiosity overwhelmed him.
Tell me more, he said.
Maybe later, she said. If you're good.
I'm the best of the best, Nate answered.
That, she said, remains to be seen.
From rug to translucent ceiling, every centimeter of Obi-Wan's suite was designed for optimal luxury. Considering the weeks in the jungles of Forescan 6, Obi-Wan had initially found it charming. As the hours passed and Snoyle hooked into Cestus's core computers, spending hour after hour absorbing mountains of legal data, Obi-Wan began to feel positively stifled. Snoyle was researching when Obi-Wan finally surrendered to sleep, and was still at it when the Jedi awakened in the morning. Snoyle's eye stalks wavered. He seemed to be fighting panic.
Never have I seen such a tangled web. Master Obi-Wan, it might take months just to dig out the actual power structure. Everything is owned by legal fictions. Every treaty not with individuals, but councils or corporations with no corporeal identity. Oh, my head hurts.
How about this regent? Obi-Wan said. Would you say she has real power?
Yes and no,
Snoyle said.
Gamai Duras represents a sop thrown to the remnants of the Hive. After all, the original contracts were all with the Jatin, so any survivors have to be honored. My guess is that she has public power, but takes orders in private.
From who? The Vipit's head bobbed side to side.
Probably these five families.
Then the air blossomed before them. A blue Tzitza with elongated lashes bobbled politely.
The regent has requested the honor of your company, she said. Will you be able to attend?
With pleasure, Obi-Wan replied. Set in a cave, large enough to comfortably hold the interstellar cruiser that had brought them to Cestus, the throne room was rather modestly furnished, less ostentatious than the Supreme Chancellor's own quarters. A tall, broad Jating female with a pale gold shell sat on the dais, and Obi-Wan recognized her immediately as Regent Duras. Her reputation was strong and honest, and her face, though unwrinkled, was grooved with the kind of deep, mild smile lines that suggested a serious and steady disposition.
Greetings, Master Kenobi. Pardon the delay. Allow me to welcome you to our world. I am Gamai Duras, Regent of Cestus.
Obi-Wan bowed. Supreme Chancellor Palpatine sends his greetings.
This is gratifying to hear, she replied. I was not certain there would be sympathetic ears in the Senate. We have gone so long with no sign that our problems or people were understood.
When you meet him, Obi-Wan said carefully, and I am certain that one day you will find the Chancellor to be a man of supreme understanding. He empathizes with your plight, and hopes as much as you to find some kind of peaceful solution.
That would be my fondest wish, she said. But make no mistake, Master Jedi. My people's welfare is my highest priority. More than my office, more than peace, more than my own life.
Obi-Wan nodded, pleased with her. I can understand how you came to power. Your clarity on the responsibilities of office is admirable. Gamai Duras nodded in turn.
Let this be the beginning of a deeper and more satisfying relationship between Ord Cestus and the rulers of the Republic. Obi-Wan held up a gently chiding finger. The Republic has no rulers, only custodians. Of course, Duris said, bowing her head. Snoyle spoke for the first time.
I am Barrister Doob Snoyle, representing the Coruscant College of Law. I make my case as clearly as possible,
he said in his soft, high voice.
By both treaty and tradition, Cestus is a signatory to the Coruscant Accords. Although technically, Cestus Cybernetics sells nothing illegal. We believe that the JK droids will be modified and used to kill Republic troops.
So you say, Duris replied. Snoyle continued on unfazed.
Therefore, it is with greatest respect that I request you to cease production and or export of any such droids as mentioned in Part 2, Paragraph 6 of the primary docufile.
Snoyle continued to speak for almost another hour, citing Republic treaties and what he had come to understand of the current legal status of Cestus Cybernetics, the Five Families, the production of security droids, and possible repercussions. Duris responded with admirable clarity. She was an encyclopedia of legalities, always firm, never impolite, intelligent and strong. But Obi-Wan knew much of this was artifice. She had to be utterly terrified. A Jating of her station, more than anyone, understood the concept of extermination. History told her more than she wanted to know about what might happen should politics end and devastation begin. In any recruitment operation, the ultimate question was, how many would respond? It was one thing for youthful would-be warriors to cheer in the fading warmth of a fine speech, quite another to rise the next day, after a night of dreams or nightmares, dress and travel a distance to the place where they would be trained to lay down their lives for the Republic. The first prospects arrived before daylight the next day, when Nate and the commandos were getting the morning brew going over an open fire and finishing their breakfasts. The first to arrive was a tall, broad-faced young man with yellow hair named Onsen. Only a few steps behind him walked another boy, shorter but even thicker across the shoulders. The newcomers were invited to rest at the fireside and share the calf. They had barely begun to speak when they heard a rolling roar and a speeder bike whizzed by. A rough-looking Jating female doffed her helmet. She smoothed her upper thorax's tufts of red wiry fur with her primary hands, dismounted from her speeder, and strode over to them. When she spoke, the roughness of her words reinforced her lower caste image.
Aye, Resta, she said. Own farm, about 100 clicks south of Chikatlik. Resta on same power grid, and they raise juice price so high, husband have to take job in mines.
There was not a shred of self-pity in her blazing, faceted green eyes.
Husband die in mines. Now Resta losing farm and all, so that power can go to some five-fam fun-fun place. Resta sick to death of backing up. Resta not backing up no more.
She added,
Gotti problem?
To the miners and farmers around her. Nate approached her and took her red-skinned hands in his, examining each of her four palms in turn. Thick calluses over the chitinous flesh. Broken nails. This female would despise soft words.
You'll do, was all he said.
All that morning, a steady stream of arrivals heartened them, until there were almost 200 prospects. It was up to the troopers to turn these farmers and miners into fighters, unless they wished to leave clone protoplasm scattered incriminatingly about. Throughout the last days, the troopers had labored to build an obstacle course. As the morning shadows shortened, they ran the recruits through their paces, forming them into lines by height, dividing them into four groups so that they could compete against each other.
running narrow rails, suspending themselves from overhead bars, lugging rocks back and forth across a field until they puked from exhaustion. The recruits suffered through standard trooper field training. During the sun's waning, Forey added calisthenics and more running, jumping, and carrying. Nate was pleased to see that every one of the new prospects was game. For some reason, he was especially pleased to see that Resta was keeping up with the off-worlders.